which I can show you.
Session number 24570-6.
Piers Plowright, Reel 6. We were talking about the friends you made amongst the assorted British personnel who shared your hut, Remy, Royal Engineers, whatever. And you were talking about a chap called Bob. If you carry on,
yeah.
What these chaps were like.
Bob was tall with a moustache, a bit of a rake. We all wore civilian clothes in the evenings, and I wore them all the time. And we'd go out to the pub. Well, not the pub. The smokehouse we did go to a couple of times, but it was very posh. There was a class system, which I noticed, even up here, that we were all privates. And even though I'd been to public school and so on, I was still a private. And the officers and the top brass, the planters and the don't forget, there's some big tea plantations up in the Cameron Highlands. The sort of, and their wives, their mem sahibs, they all came to the smokehouse and places like that and drank pink gins and talked about, you know, Camberley and that sort of thing. And we didn't belong there. I once went and I felt out of fish out of water. So I much preferred to go locally to the little Chinese or Indian shops and talk multiracially. I had friends of the other groups, which I'll come to. There was a wonderful old soak, what do I call him, old soldier, regular. I think his name was Bob too, but not to be confused with the other Bob. And he got it down to a T really, as little work as possible, lots of drinking. Every weekend he'd go down to Ypres for a bit of how's your father. And every night, I remember, because I used to go to bed quite early, and I was still, you know, a bit of a sort of intellectual snob, so I'd be reading Kierkegaard or something, and I'd hear Bob coming across the yard, and you knew he was coming from the naffy because of the clinking of bottles. And sometimes I was in the mood for Bob, and sometimes I wasn't. So if I wasn't, I'd put my head under blankets and be fast asleep, apparently, by the time Bob arrived, because he needed somebody to talk to. And as a matter of fact, even if nobody was awake, he still went in for long monologues. Got the feeling he was an unhappy soul in many ways, perhaps a wife back in Blighty. But the love of his life was called Horseface. And she was a Chinese prostitute in Ypres, and she looked, I must say, like a horse. She was no beauty, but obviously a generous nature and popular with the lads, particularly with this Bob. So he'd talk a lot about Horseface, whether he was thinking of marrying her or what, I don't know. There'd be quite a lot of sexual talk, which I'd long ceased to be shocked by. I mean, when I first joined the army, I did find it rather shocking. But by this time, you realise this was a way of life and a way of talking, and the fact that it was effing this, effing that, you soon sort of forgot it. I still wasn't swearing myself, by the way. I still held on to my priggishness to the end. But Bob would reminisce and talk and perhaps tell you about the old days. I should guess he was no more than 45, but he looked to me about 108. You know, he was grizzled and the drink was telling on him, but he seemed to manage to get through the day where I suppose he was an engineer or mechanical engineer of some kind. I don't quite know what he did, but tinkering with vehicles. So he would talk about Horseface, and the other guys, there was a very, very nice guy whose name's completely gone, another public school boy, who was in Remy, and broad, sort of rather stocky man who walked with a kind of swagger like he'd just come off a ship. And I really liked him, though he was a little bit prim. I was fairly prim, but he was even primmer. He was, I think, low church. And I haven't talked about religion. I was and am religious, but I don't remember going to church in Malaya. This may have been to do with the fact I got so interested in other cultures. Apart from going to the Indian evangelical church outside Ypres and teaching Sunday school there, I don't think I went to church in the Cameron Highlands, though there was a little Anglican church and a visiting RC chaplain. This chap, whose name I've forgotten, I think he might have had Bible readings or Bible groups or something, and occasionally we'd read the Bible together. Very nice guy, engaged to be married, going back, probably became a chartered accountant or something like that, I'm not sure. But I liked him very much, can't remember his name. Those are the guys who stick out. Jerry, the two Bobs, this guy. And I do remember Christmas, which was actually not bad because it was quite cold and we had a Christmas turkey and everything in the canteen. And
did you have all the
all the trimmings? All the, yeah, we had, I mean, not holly, but sort of wreaths were hung up, bunting of various kinds, the full meal, the full works.
Did the officers serve you in that?
Yes, although there were hardly any officers there, but maybe the sergeant did. There was a sergeant. Maybe Captain Lynn came in. I used to babysit for him. He had a nice little house beyond the village, wife and two children. And I remember babysitting, and the great thing was a fridge full of cold beer. And I found a book on his bookshelf that's remained one of my favourite ever books, and it's called Voss by Patrick White. And it's about a man, a true story, of a German explorer who sort of went into the interior of Australia in the 1890s, something like that. Story of heroism and pluck. And I was mesmerised by this book. Anyway, that was a sort of European evening, because I was babysitting. Otherwise, my evenings were with the lads, or with
What would a typical lad's night out be?
Well, we'd all go to the Chinese cafe. Ball's father's photography shop.
Well, and tell me about this Chinese cafe.
You've got to imagine something pretty small, say 10 tables, a little back room where it was all the cooking was done, and you could get noodles and you could get these lovely pao, these Chinese dumplings with pork in them, which I absolutely loved, and you could get sweet pao too, I mean hot, but with sweet meats in them, or something sweet, sugar, something like that. You got lots of fresh fruits, you got the crushed ice in long cold drinks, but mostly we drank Tiger beer, which is a very good beer actually. And we didn't get up to anything particularly awful, it was mainly talk. There were girls, maybe some of the lads went off with them, but I didn't. And most of the photographs I have show groups of men raising glasses in a jolly way to each other. The talk was sometimes intellectual. I remember, you just brought something back to me there, there was a school near the smokehouse inn, near the golf course, which had some expatriate teachers in it. I suspect the school was mixed race, but it was quite posh because it was a boarding school. It sounds odd to have had a boarding school up there in the jungle, but maybe they had guards all around it, and anyway the emergency was running down. And there were two teachers, one particular who was a real intellectual of a kind I had never met apart from my history tutor at school. Welshman, I think. And he'd been trained as a philosopher. And I remember enormous arguments. We would go over there, two or three of us, perhaps this serious guy who was going to become a chartered accountant and me, and a couple of the teachers at the school, and the beer would be brought out and the nuts, and maybe we had some proper food. And I was into C.S. Lewis and Christianity and the arguments for it, and this guy was very deeply versed in sort of Socratic philosophy. So the evenings became his debunking, in fact dismantling, of my religious belief through Socratic argument, which used to leave me upset and indignant but vaguely stimulated. So these were sort of high points intellectually. It sounds a bit silly sitting in the jungle talking about C.S. Lewis versus Socrates, but anyway, that's what we were doing. But back in the town, we would talk. John Lamb would join us sometimes. Other people whose names I've forgotten would come in, the Indian barber, and we'd stand them drinks. It was very friendly. Let's not forget that being white was still Orang Putih, the white man, Orang Man, Putih, P-U-T-E-H, white, still had a certain cachet. You know, we were sort of, we were still running the place in a strange way, and if people didn't like us, they kept it to themselves. And we didn't misbehave up there. I didn't see any cases of drunkenness, smashing windows, ill-treating locals. It was such a small group. We integrated rather well.
So, the Malays, the Indians, the Chinese, your little group of lads from the Rimi and the rest of it, behaved well to all?
I think we did, and I think we were accepted. There's another racial group I haven't mentioned, that's the Dayaks. Most of the trackers in the jungle, who really knew the jungle, were either Aborigines, people who'd been there since ever, and you've got a fairly raw deal from the British until they realised that actually these guys could be very helpful in combating the communists and we needed to win their hearts and minds. And so that they got, you know, there was a protector of Aborigines for each area. They were the trackers, but they tended to live deep jungle, and we didn't see many of them unless they came out with a patrol. Or the Ibans brought over from Borneo, who had a similar terrain to work in and really knew everything about jungle sights, sounds and smells. And a few, one or two Ibans, I think there was an Iban attached to our camp.
Are they collectively known as Dayaks?
No. Dayaks meant people from Borneo. An Iban is a sea Dayak, and there's another kind of Dayak, but they were mostly sea Dayaks who came. So we would say Abos for the Aborigines, who we didn't see much of, as I say, and Dayaks. I think the KGGs, the King's Dragoon Guards, had a Dayak tracker or two always with a patrol, and they would come into town. The King's Dragoon Guards used to roll in, and they were different because they were regimental and they could be get quite drunk and so on, and the officers were frightfully pucker. I mean, it was a crack regiment, and the officers were all these rather laconic, young, slim, beautifully turned out, polished boots, sort of, and if they saluted, it was sort of very casual, you know, a leisurely hand went up to the peak of their cap and back again, and they all spoke like this, you know, and they were my age, but I felt dreadfully inferior in their presence, probably because I was from their class but hadn't made it to their rank.
So they would presumably go to the smokehouse?
They would, but they'd occasionally come into town, and the men would, not, you know, the officers would go to the smokehouse, but occasionally came in with the men, and we'd sort of have slightly uneasy conversations with them. It wasn't so relaxed. I was glad when they went. You know, who entered.
And what about the ordinary lads, the other ranks of the King's Dragoon?
They were just, I felt rather with them as I'd felt in the big barrack room in Ypres, that, you know, guardedly we got on, but we hadn't a lot in common.
How did they get on with the Malay and various forces?
I don't remember any sort of bad incidents, but I think there were drunk scenes and bottles thrown, as you get with a collection of people from the same regiment who come in for a good time. You know, you're almost bound to have an incident of a kind.
Now, what other things of entertainment were? I mean, we haven't actually mentioned the naffy much yet.
No, well, the naffy was tiny in our little thing. It was another hut with four or five tables and just dealing with the 20 or 30 men in the little compound. So it was very small, probably Chinese run. I'm not sure they had British staff there.
What did it offer?
It offered sandwiches. I mean, being Malayanized, I think you got curry and noodles and things like that rather than fish and chips. You know, you went, I mean, people who got acclimatized to and rather fond of local food. And it was very, very cheap. You know, on my $20 or whatever it was, weekly pay, I could manage.
So, would there be games or anything in there?
There was a piano, and one guy played the piano. And I was at that stage wanting to be a pianist, but wasn't any good at all. And I used to sometimes go in and practice my two-finger pieces, but never played publicly. I remember the rongeng coming to the Padang. The rongeng is a Malay dance, which is a very odd mixture of the chaste and the sexual. What it is it's a raised platform, always built up, a little band playing sort of local music with a kind of nice beat to it, and these lovely girls in sarong kabayas, which is the long sarong bottom and the little jackets, kabayas at the top. Very made up. They always seemed powdered, so they were almost like clowns. And they would dance this little swaying backward and forward dance, and anybody could get up and go up on the platform and dance with them if they were free, but you didn't hold them. The rongeng was movement forward, movement back, movement forward, movement back, moving your hands, wiggling your bum, but never actually making contact. So it had that kind of frisson of sexual excitement without anything ever happening, and there were all, sort of a lot of guys looking on to make sure that no further contact took place, though what went on behind the bike sheds, I've no idea. But it was a great moment, and the Sultan came one day for such a wronging. The Sultan of Pahang, as people probably know, the Malaysia still is ruled in name by a collection of sultans, one for each province, each state. And there's a supreme sultan each year. Is it for 5 years they hold the office? Yang Di Patuan Agong, he who is crowned king, elected from amongst the sultans. This was one for Pahang, which was the state we were in. And he came with his six wives or whatever, and sat and watched in benign friendliness, and I think took part in the dance. So I remember that was a big day. That must have been some, like his birthday or something like that, that he came. I also remember another rather poignant friend up there who was a Eurasian, ex-postman or postmaster. And he lived in a little house with his wife and two or three children across the Padang. It was on stilts and it was shabby. It had a picture of the Queen, a picture of various calendars of England round the walls. And he spoke, the Asian side of him was Indian, and I think his father had gone, but had been some kind of a English-British official. I can't remember his name, but he gave me cups of sweet tea, and he loved to talk about Britain and England. And he didn't belong. He was he wouldn't engage much with Malays, Chinese, and Indians because they were inferior to him, and he was despised, the classic thing by English society. So he lived this lonely life, but he and I struck up a friendship. And I had these regular teas. I think I also entertained him. I don't think he came to the camp, but he came maybe to the little village and we had tea together.
What about the planters, the British?
I only saw them in the distance, or I believe there was a Christmas party given by my captain, probably in his house, to which I went rather shyly, and there it was all planters and more senior officers and wives and possibly the odd child out from England, I can't remember. And that was, you know, very formal, but I didn't quite belong, though I did my best.
But you didn't have much contact with them?
No, not really. Saw them in the distance. There was something else that I was thinking of, and it's gone.
Okay. What about you? What, any other sort of evening recreational things? I mean, you mentioned brothels. I know you didn't.
Yes. Oh, about the prostitutes. I mean, I should say that once a week, perhaps I have said this, I went down, once a month, I went down to Ypres. And occasionally, that was a duty trip, and we might stay a night there, or we might come back the same day. It's quite a long drive. I think we usually did it in the same day. We sometimes stopped at Tapa, the rest house there, where you get excellent food and cool fans and things, before beginning the ascent back up the hill, if we were in time. But I would also go to Ypres for leave from time to time and stay in a cheap Chinese hotel where obviously prostitutes came and one heard noises in the night and one saw the guys, very beautiful girls, a lot of them. For some reason I didn't go for that. Can't quite explain why. Was it shyness or virtue? I don't know. But I observed it. VD was much talked about, and as I think I said earlier, medical officers were hot onto that and you were checked. You had medical inspections. I can't remember how often in my case, but I know in the regiments, you know, they were fairly regular because people obviously caught it and it could be got rid of fairly simply. So there were those expeditions. I had a rest and recreation long trip, I mean something like 3 weeks, when I went to Penang and Hong Kong.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, I went to Penang with a friend. This friend of mine who wasn't... Yes, he was Intelligence Corps, but he stayed on in Ypres, and his name was Graham Forward. And I've lost touch with him. We used to write for a bit to each other. He and I decided we'd, you know, do this three-week round trip to Hong Kong, the P&O line, and leaving from Penang. So let me guess that it was sort of February 58, something like that. We went to Penang, which was a lovely town then, still pretty nice, but a bit spoiled. My wife comes from there, but that's another story. And we had a good time swimming, and then perhaps a couple of days in Penang. There was an army club you could stay in, but I think, again, Graham and I both shied clear of that and stayed in some cheap Chinese hotel. And then we embarked on a P&O liner. You're going to ask me its name, and I've forgotten.
Right.
But I do remember the trip, because suddenly, from being soldiers, we were being waited on, hand and foot, this rather nice dining room, and Mr. Nugent, the steward, who I suppose nowadays we would call Camp, we thought he was marvellous. He flapped his arms a lot, he had a sort of slightly high-pitched voice, but he was so nice and kind to us, and he picked us out, us two particularly, as being soldiers who'd needed a bit of cosseting, and he'd come over and say, what would you like today, boys, and that sort of thing. There was no innuendo. I mean, I don't think he was after anything. He was just jolly sweet to us. And we got to Hong Kong and anchored in the harbour, and this was breathtaking. Hong Kong in 58 was a little town. None of those great skyscrapers existed. There were one or two high-rise buildings, mostly slums, and the peak going up and up and up, and the higher up the peak you were, the grander you were, and they were all British at the top. And I remember, through my father, I had an introduction to Mr. and Mrs. Dixon Leach, who were very high up in Shell, I think, and sort of also very high up the peak. And they asked me to dinner. And I went. Don't think Graham came to that. And it was terribly pucker. And it was quietly racist, in the sense that there were no Chinese there, lots of Chinese servants. And it was grumbling. It's quite an extraordinary aspect of British colonialism that the more comfortable they are, the more they grumble about you can't get the servants, and they're so slack, and you can't trust anybody, and, oh, we're so looking forward to our leave, and so on. And there they were, in a paradise, I thought. But anyway, you know. And at the dinner, now, Stanley Matthews was there, and he played for... Isn't it awful? I said Man U to my son, he said rubbish.
Blackpool.
I think it was Blackpool. Anyway, Stanley Matthews and half the team were there because they must have been playing in that area. And, of course, I was ignoramus, and I had no idea who this guy was. I sat next to him. But I liked him tremendously, and he wasn't snobbish and racist. He was earthy, and he told me a bit about football, and he was interested in me, you know, which I thought was terrific. He actually bothered to ask me what I was doing and things. So that was a kind of posh evening out. Otherwise, it was just relishing the food and the life of Hong Kong. I do remember one other expedition through my father's contacts with a British lot. We went sailing, and again, I was quickly appalled by their quietly racist attitude that they never thought of having Chinese friends or living a sort of Chinese life. It was the office, going back to Blighty, the sailing club, how much you could drink. You know, there was nothing vicious about them. They just were narrow and not looking outwards. I, by this time, Chinese culture in particular had absolutely got me. Calligraphy, which I could do a bit of, I loved. And I would browse around the Chinese bookshops and shelter from the rain and carry one of these lovely banana leaf umbrellas, which you could buy very, very cheaply, and they varnished the top and they gave you terrific shelter. And I'd never seen such rain. It seemed to have rained all the time. And it was wonderful. And we looked at the new territories from the hill, and I went into the walled city of Kam Tin, Kamtin, which was the last relic of how a Chinese village would have been. It wasn't a city, a village. So that you had a wall right round it, alleys, temple in the middle, laid out on an absolutely grid plan with the curly roofs and the tiles and the dragons that you know from films, you know. And that was pretty terrific. I didn't know anything about the opium or the triads or any of that stuff. I didn't see it. It was free time, and because I was in civilian clothes and had come on a civilian liner, I escaped totally military life during that time. Bought a lot of presents, came back via Penang, disembarked, goodbye to Mr. Nugent, train, and back to the Cameron Highlands for my last March, April, May, another 6 months of duty, where, again, don't remember quite what order the various incidents that I've earlier described came, but it seemed to me things were quietening down and it became rather quite a lot of leisure to explore. And I one day remember going on my own very far up the track, further than you were supposed to go for safety, to the Bo Tea Estate, B-O-H, which is a marvellous... I mean, if you've seen fields of tea, those sort of cone-shaped bushes, and I sat there, and I had a little cine camera. I'd bought my first ever cine camera, and the tragedy is I've lost the film and everything that I took. I remember trying to change the film under a Chinese coolie hat in the middle of the tea estate so that the light wouldn't get in. And I just wandered along the track and off into the tea estates, and I suppose in a way it was a bit silly, but as I say, one didn't feel much danger. Nobody stopped me. And I stayed wherever I mean, it was away to a couple of days. This must have been a weekend, I think. And I stayed in a sort of Chinese temple which had accommodation next to it one night. And I stayed with an Indian family another night, just literally knocking on the door. You know, it was that sort of very friendly atmosphere. And again, being European, I seemed to get a welcome, you know, a certain amount of kowtowing going on, I suspect. But I did love the people, and felt very happy and relaxed amongst them, and my Malay was by this time quite good. So that was an expedition.
Any other expeditions or you know, ways you spent your leisure time?
Into Ypres, if we were going for a town outing, I remember swimming in tin mine pools, which was sounds ridiculous, but you see, there wasn't much water about. Ah, there was one up in Cameron Highs I come to, but on the plane, I would occasionally, if I went to Ypres, I'd made a group of friends, Chinese friends, and we'd all go off to one of these tin mine pools. The water actually was pretty warm, but it was refreshing, and we'd find bits of floating log, and we'd kind of rest on the logs as if they were rafts and just kick with our feet and stay there ages and then come out and eat some Chinese food and bicycle. How did I have a bicycle? I must have borrowed one, because I remember bicycling along these roads in the heat, looking a bit odd, you know, mad dogs and Englishmen and so on, and then go back to Ypres and stay the night. I think it was a village called Greentown where I had a Chinese friend and he used to put me up. So I did that, and the water in the Cameron Highlands, I'd forgotten that. If you crossed the Padang and passed my Eurasian friend's house and took a little jungle path, there was a kind of walking area which people promenaded at weekends. It wasn't thick jungle. And you came to a clearing with the most lovely waterfall and a pool of fairly cool water. And that was the great bathing place. And you'd go there and jump in and swim and refresh yourself. And didn't bother to dry, you just sat in the sun until you were dry and changed and came home again. That was a refreshment. There was football or even rugby on the playing field, but I didn't do any of that. I wasn't that keen. Team games. Might have been cricket. Don't remember that. Golf, I had one go at. Disaster. And again, it was all a bit sort of pucker and people looking disapproving behind you, you know. So I decided that wasn't for me and I didn't play it again.
As things wound down, I mean, you had less and less insurgents to keep track of.
And I have a feeling, which may be wrong, that perhaps before August, when I think August or September, I departed, it must have been August, I was moved back down to Ypres and then by slow degrees to Singapore, because I do remember being seen off at Ypres station on a train that was taking me to Singapore and back home by ship again.
Before we go on, any other stories, just as a sweep up, about your time up
in the Cameron Highlands? No, I remember the mist rolling over the hills, so some days visibility was very, very poor. A lot of cloud, which of course brought rain and brought coolness.
What was the weather like? Yes. A bit about the climate.
Well, down below, it's a steady 90 plus with these amazing afternoon rainstorms. There's a rainy season where it rains more often, but almost daily there seemed to be rain, and that's why, of course, the huge monsoon drains run through all the towns, because tropical rain is like nothing you've ever seen in Britain. It's absolutely vertical, sheet-like, relentless, not for long, but in that time, if you didn't have monsoon drains, that everything would be flooded. Up in the Cameron Highlands, let's say the temperature had been 95 or so steadily down below, I should think it sank to the 70s, which seemed pretty good. And at night, lower still. And rain must have come, but I don't remember those relentless downpours. Was it that being high up in the hills you got sort of cloud? I can't quite remember this. There must have been tropical day. We had the drains and everything just the same. And I do remember once going for a haircut. And it was always the same when you went to the barbers, Indian barbers, lots of beautiful smelling soaps and unguents of various kinds. And this high-pitched Indian female singing off the radio that went on all the time. And the clatter of the clippers, which were rather old-fashioned. And I didn't go for those days. I didn't have to do short back and sides. I was able to be vaguely fashionable, you know, not back to my standards pre-army, but nobody seemed to come round tapping you, and particularly as I was wearing civilian clothes. The only time I put uniform on, I do remember this, was the pay parades, which were on a Friday, I think. And they went through this formal thing of a table and the pay officer and the sergeant, and you shouted, they called you, and you came to the front and did this salute and shouted out your name and number. But I remember a particular pay parade because I'd lost my boots or something, and I was wearing shoes which had come apart. So when I marched forward, it sounded like two people were marching because the shoes were going ka-cloff, 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 you see. And I wondered whether he was going to say anything, but he didn't. So the sound of the shoes and the nervousness was a day I remember, not of great significance.